Lizzie Borden took an axe, gave her mother 40 whacks. When she saw what she had done, gave her father 41. Like that.
Welcome to the Lizzie Borden Podcast, Episode 5. The Lizzie Borden Podcast is a Nine Muses Books production. This is the only podcast devoted to Lizzie Borden and the Borden murders of 1892. Episode 5, A Lizzie Borden Primer. Today on the Lizzie Borden Podcast, we return to the Lizzie Borden Primer. I'll be talking to Sarah Miller, author of the Borden Murders, Lizzie Borden and the Trial of the Century. She's been helping us walk through the details of Lizzie Borden's life and the events leading up to the murders of August 4th, 1892. In previous episodes, we talked about Fall River and its importance in colonial New England, and King Philip's War, the Indian Revolt in 1675 that led to the establishment of a settlement on the Quickishon River. We talked about the Borden family and how they rose from property and mill owners to a family made rich and powerful by the textile industry and the Fall River steamship line. We took a look at Lizzie Borden's childhood. She was born into a modest branch of the family, the daughter of Andrew Jackson Borden, a furniture dealer, who chose to live near his businesses in the downtown area rather than up on the hill with the other Fall River millionaires. We followed Lizzie on her grand tour of Europe to celebrate her 30th birthday and the strange events leading up to the summer of 1892, including a burglary that some suspect was perpetrated by Lizzie herself, and a dispute over a real estate deal that may have created a deadly rift between Lizzie and her stepmother, Abby Borden. We took a look at August 3rd, a day when many weird events occurred, including the whole family coming down with food poisoning, and a woman who may or may not have been Lizzie Borden attempting to buy prussic acid in the local pharmacy. That evening, Lizzie complained to a neighbor that someone was out to hurt her family, and she slept with one eye open in fear that someone would burn her house down, and that the food poisoning may have been deliberate. We left our listeners at the fall of night as the Borden family drew the covers on their last day of normalcy, and for some, the last day of life. Now we're going to pick up our story with Sarah Miller and discuss the day of the murders and the Lizzie Borden Primer, Part 2. Okay, we're back with Sarah Miller, the author of The Borden Murders, Lizzie Borden and the Trial of the Century, published by Random House Children's Books and available online. More information about Sarah's books could be found at www.sarahmillerbooks.com. Welcome back, Sarah.
Hi.
Hi. Today we're going to pick up where we left off in the last episode.
That means we're going to do the gory part.
Yes. This is what everyone wants to hear. Spoiler alert, we're not actually going to solve the murder.
Oh.
Last time we followed the Bordens right up to the night of August 3rd, 1892. We talked about the odd events that occurred in the day before the murders, including the family suffering the effects of what appeared to be food poisoning, Lizzie Borden's alleged trip to a drugstore to try to purchase prussic acid, a substance that could have been used to murder a family. And we also discussed the visit of Uncle John, John Vinnicum Morse, who was Lizzie Borden's biological uncle. He comes into town the day before to do business with Andrew Borden and decides to spend the night. Lizzie Borden goes around the corner to her friend Alice Russell's house and has some sort of paranoid fit in which she starts talking about people trying to hurt her family. A very curious incident that sheds light on the events of the next day, but also creates a lot of mystery and raises a lot of questions. So we're going to pick up with the Bordens right now as they wake up on the morning of August 4th, 1892. Now, Sarah, in reading the trial transcripts, the preliminary hearings, etc., there's a lot about timing. There's a lot about who woke up when, who had breakfast when, you know, the movements of the families around the house. How do we summarize this without getting into a lot of detail, without bogging down into an elaborate timetable?
The really quick and dirty version is it was a pretty typical morning. The elder Bordens woke up first and Uncle John around the same time. I want to say around 6:37 in the morning. You know, they get up, they bring down their slop pails and so forth, maybe brush their teeth, sit down to breakfast. It was not Lizzie's custom to rise early. It was not generally her custom to have very much breakfast, so her not being present was not unusual. But, yeah, they just, you know, they got up, they had breakfast. Mrs. Borden started her chores. She had a little chat with Bridget about what she would like Bridget to do, aside from the standard daily duties. She mentioned the windows were dirty. She'd like to have them washed. Uncle John and Mr. Borden sit down in the sitting room for a little while, have a short visit, and then Uncle John goes out. He had some visits to make in town, and the rest of the family just goes about their normal business.
Okay, that's a good summary. There's a few details to add to that morning. That does make it a little strange. It is a little strange that Lizzie did make it a habit not to have breakfast with her family. She did come down a little later than that. And again, she does not say hello to Uncle John, her uncle who she hasn't seen in a long time. She came in the night before, didn't say hello to him, wakes up on the morning of the 4th, doesn't make any effort to talk to him or say hello.
Now, he's presumably gone before she even comes downstairs.
And another detail about the morning that does make it a little more than typical is that everybody is sick, or a considerable number of them are sick. Some of them are nauseous. Some of them are vomiting in the backyard.
Yeah, Bridget was ill that morning. You're right. I'd forgotten that. Because everybody else had been sick the morning before, Wednesday morning. But Bridget said she had a headache. I think she called it a sick headache. And she did run out. She was sick in the yard. She said she was outside for about 10 minutes being sick.
Later on, when the police claim that they searched every square inch of the backyard, I always think of that.
They don't mention exactly what they found.
Also, the practice of emptying the slop pails in the backyard also comes to mind when I hear the police say they searched every square inch.
Well, and should we get into the difference between the slop pail and the chamber pot?
Well, you raise that in your book, and I found that very interesting. I assume that they had both slop pails and chamber pots upstairs.
Yeah, because we hear that, and it sounds gross. Chamber pail sounds, even though you probably know what's in there, it's the name itself sounds a little less yuck. But the slop pail apparently was just your leftover wash water from your pitcher and basin. So you may have washed your hands and face. You may have brushed your teeth in it. It's basically bath water and not toilet water. Bridget is very clear about when Andrew Borden goes out and dumps his slop pail under the pear tree. And then he goes out to, you know, bring in some pears for breakfast. And you go, wait a minute. But it's not what it seems.
The chamber pot most likely would have been emptied into the privy.
Yes.
Right. And there's a privy in the basement. There was a privy in the backyard. So on this morning of people still feeling a little under the weather from possible food poisoning the night before, Abby Borden directs Bridget to start cleaning the windows. And Bridget Sullivan, the Borden's domestic, she goes outside and she immediately starts getting together all her materials. Her long-handled mop, you know, her bucket, she starts getting water into the bucket. She's essentially out, this is roughly 9 o'clock and 9 a.m.?
Yeah, 9 and 9:30 or 10? It's hard to say with very much precision. I mean, we have a general idea, but although Bridget has this reputation for being very precise, she's more consistent than she is precise in reality. So, yeah, it's hard to pin a precise time on it. Certainly around 9:30, anyhow, she was out there.
And 9:30 is around the time that it is generally suspected that Abby Borden was murdered in the upstairs guest room.
Mr. Borden had gone out on his errands.
So there's a timeline here in which at some point Bridget goes about her task to clean the windows, starting with the outside of the house. Abby Borden goes upstairs. She does say she's going to clean the guest room, and the guest room was used by John Morse the night before. And John Morse himself goes off to visit relatives from his side of the family. He goes over to Weybosset Street from the Borden house. I believe that he walked there and he took a streetcar back.
Now, that's what he said. Whether or not he was accurate is another question. But.
Right. So if we have Andrew Borden going out for a walk to attend to some of his business in town, we have Bridget on the outside of the house cleaning the windows. We have Abby in the upstairs guest room. We don't have a location on Lizzie. And this is during the window of opportunity for Lizzie to have murdered her stepmother in the guest room.
Lizzie came down when Bridget was kind of making her way out with her tools for window washing. She spoke with her stepmother briefly because Abby asked if what she would like for dinner, which meant the noon meal. They did their shopping on a daily basis. Mrs. Borden asked Lizzie also, this is something I wasn't able to squish into my book, asked her to address the newspaper wrappers, which apparently if you were a subscriber, you put your address on these wrapper things and then sent them to the paper, who then sent them back full of newspapers a day at a time. And she agreed to do that. Grabbed maybe a cup of coffee and some cookies or a banana. She couldn't really remember. And then everything starts to get pretty vague. Mrs. Borden was last seen in the dining room by Bridget dusting. Yeah, Bridget goes outside, Abby goes about her business, and Lizzie's just kind of floating around the house. She said she, at that point, was when she set up her little ironing board, and it is just, it's cute, it's this little miniature ironing board on the dining room table to iron some handkerchiefs.
So at this point, Lizzie Borden conceivably could have been alone in the house with Abby Borden.
Yes. Absolutely.
And if she did commit the murder, this would have been her opportunity. And considering the forensic evidence suggests that the murder occurred around this time.
Everything that we know points very clearly to Lizzie and Abby being alone in the house. If there was another person, it was, as they say, person or persons unknown.
And we have Abby Borden saying, I'm going to go upstairs to clean the guest room.
Yes, I'm going to put pillow slips on the pillows, which Lizzie herself said that errand should have taken 2 to 3 minutes.
And we find several hours later, she's found up there in the guest room in clothes that she would have worn while cleaning the house, not clothes she would have worn while going outside. We find her dead. So at this point in the story, Abby Borden kind of disappears and Lizzie and Bridget are alone in the house because Bridget has, she's finished washing the windows outside. She comes inside to start washing the windows from the inside. Yeah, meanwhile, Andrew Borden, the father, he's gone on his perambulation. He's gone up, he's visited two of his banks. He stopped in on a construction site. He had rented out a building and it was being renovated, and he chatted with the workers who were at that site down on South Main Street. And he circles back to the house. And he arrives back sometime between 10:45 and 11 o'clock. And he comes into the house and, well, he tries to enter the house through the side door, but the hook and eye is locked on the screen.
Presumably by Bridget, who has come in to wash the inside of the windows.
Right. So he kind of grumbles and he walks back to the front of the house, takes out his key, tries his key, and he notices that it's not working because someone has drawn a bolt. So he knocks on the door. And Bridget goes to open the door. And Bridget has a little bit of trouble sliding the bolt out. She shouts out, like, for lack of a better term, a Gaelic curse word.
Yeah, she says, pshaw, which I guess was something polite enough that you could say it in court without blushing. But I read somewhere here and there, there's sort of suggestions that people seem to have known maybe she'd said something a little stronger than that.
Either way, while she utters this word, behind her, over her shoulder, up the staircase, she hears somebody giggle. Presumably, Lizzie Borden was standing at the top of the stairs giggling at her use of that word. And the consequences of Lizzie being up there at the top of the stairs are there's a lot of consequences. One of them is that if she was standing at the top of the stairs, she's standing a few feet away from the dead body of Abby Borden, who's in the guest room. To be fair to Lizzie, if she was standing up there from her position on the landing, she would not have been able to see the body because it was behind the bed. But the fact that she was up there was made into a big deal at her inquest testimony when Jose Knowlton tries to nail her down to where exactly were you when your father came home. And she keeps waffling around. I was in the kitchen. I was upstairs. I was in my room. I was putting a tape on my dress. You know, she can't seem to commit herself to say where she was when her father came home.
And it's reasonably clear to us that the time between Abby's murder and Andrew's return home is probably a pretty slim window. So for Lizzie to have been up there, you wonder, was she up there when it was happening? Is that possible?
So Mr. Borden comes into the house. He's not feeling very well. He's still feeling some of the after effects of the food poisoning.
Yeah.
He goes into his sitting room. As a matter of fact, some of the people on the street who saw him, they testified that he looked pale. He didn't look well.
Yeah.
So he goes home to take a nap. And Lizzie kind of encourages him to get onto the couch. She even helps him get into position. I believe she folds up his coat as like a little pillow for him.
Yeah, and it's hard to tell which parts of that scenario come from Lizzie herself and which come from Uncle Hiram Harrington, who makes quite a big to-do about that whole helping him down to nap, where she's much more matter-of-fact about it. But yes, he did certainly show some concern for him and his comfort.
And there's little inconsistencies here and there, like Lizzie took his boots off.
Yeah.
And in the crime scene photograph, you can clearly see his boots are on. Now, his boots could have been put back on by people who took the crime scene photograph, but that's all controversial. That's all something that nobody really knows what happened with those boots.
Yeah. She asked him about the blinds, if he wants the shutters open or closed. I know that came straight from Lizzie herself. Yeah. And she did say that she'd folded up his coat for him. But yeah, Uncle Hiram, he kind of skews that in a very particular way that makes it feel very suspicious, and it kind of gives you the willies, where Lizzie's testimony does not. Just says, I helped him out a little.
Andrew Borden is now in his sitting room. Lizzie is kind of, one weird thing that she does at that moment is she tells Bridget about a sale up at a department store up on North Main Street. She tells her that there's a sale on cloth and that Bridget should go check it out. It's almost like she's wink-winking her, trying to get her out of the house.
It does give that feeling. And I think Bridget said, well, I'm going to have one of those, because it was so many cents per yard and was apparently a good deal. And if you look in the papers, you can actually see the advertisements. So that was a true thing. It wasn't something Lizzie was making up to get her out of the house.
But Bridget doesn't leave the house. She goes upstairs to take a nap because she's not feeling well herself. She's been throwing up during that morning. She's been feeling nauseous. And she just spent an hour or so cleaning the windows in the house. So she goes upstairs to her third floor room up in the attic. And this is sometime around 11 o'clock.
Yeah, a little before, but yeah, we really don't know.
Meanwhile, according to Lizzie Borden, Lizzie Borden is now alone with her father down in the bottom part of the house. And according to her, based on her inquest testimony, which is a little hard to follow because she keeps contradicting herself, but she presumably leaves her father to nap. She puts on her straw hat. She leaves. She goes out into the barn. And according to her, she went out there looking for some, what she describes as lead sinkers for a fishing trip. And she has pulled some pears off of the backyard pear tree. And she's in the barn kind of munching on her pears. From her perspective, she spent anywhere from 10 to 20 minutes in the barn, kind of zoning out and eating these pears. And when asked why she took so long to eat the pears, she's famously said, because I can't do anything in a minute.
Yep.
Which screams out to be made into a bumper sticker of some sort or a t-shirt.
My other favorite, which we may or may not get to later, is I was feeling well enough to eat the pears.
Right. Now she comes back from the barn. Now she says that she heard a scraping noise.
A scraping or a groan. Yeah, it depends on whether you read the witness statements or the inquest testimony. It's not always the same phrasing.
Right. Now whether somebody who is outside the house, between the barn and the house, whether you could hear a groan from a hatchet murder.
Yeah.
Or whether someone could even groan, period, after being slammed into the face with a hatchet 11 times.
Well, when you consider that, an hour before, she had almost certainly been inside the house while Abby was murdered and heard nothing. Yeah, that's a little, what?
So it's Lizzie who comes into the house at roughly very shortly after 11 o'clock, maybe a few minutes after 11. It's Lizzie who sees the body on the couch. I think just for those who may know the inside of the house, she comes in through the kitchen. All the doors are presumably closed. So she comes into the doors inside the house, I mean. She comes into the kitchen. She goes in through one door of the dining room, puts her hat down, checks her irons to see whether they're hot or not, goes to check on her father, and she peers out through the second door in the dining room.
Which puts her right at that arm of the sofa.
Yeah, she would have looked down straight into his face while he's lying there. I mean, if she were innocent, that would have been a horrific moment.
And if she were guilty, that's basically where she was standing to murder him.
Right, that's where direction of the hatchet blows came from. Also based upon the pattern of the blood splattered on the walls, they could tell where the killer was standing. So she's the one who raises the alarm. Now, if she's guilty, that means that she had control over when to raise the alarm. And she raises the alarm by yelling up the stairs, the back stairs.
Yeah, Bridget, come down quick.
Bridget, come down quick. Does she say, like, someone has hurt father?
That, again, is not entirely clear whether she says hurt or killed. Her own inquest testimony says that obviously she recognized he was very wounded. She was claimed to be not sure whether he was alive or dead. His face was such a mess. It was very clear that he needed some serious help real fast.
Right. And the murder must have happened very, very soon before this because the blood was still flowing from the wounds.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, blood was still flowing from the wounds when the first doctor arrived on the scene about 10 minutes later. So this was a very fresh kill. So she calls down Bridget, and Bridget is obviously horrified at what she sees. And Lizzie's first instinct is to go get Dr. Bowen across the street. So Bridget runs over. Dr. Bowen is not home. Ironically, Dr. Bowen is visiting the house on Way Bossett Street where Uncle John had been, because somebody in that house was sick. So that's a weird circularity of alibis there. Very strange. We can get into that in a future episode, because I'm very curious about that part. As a matter of fact, there's a whole book out now, a new Uncle John Did It book that examines all that in minute detail. I don't really believe in his conclusions, but it does raise some issues.
Yeah, and I wasn't able to tell for sure if the Bowen story about him, he was clearly out making house calls. That's not, you know, there's no debate there. I was unable to determine did I believe or not that he was at Way Bossett Street. But yeah, who knows?
So Bridget comes back from Dr. Bowen's house empty-handed. You know, he's out. He's tending to another patient. Lizzie's next instinct is not to say call the police. It's run around the corner and get Alice Russell.
Get Alice Russell. I can't be alone in this house, she says.
Right. And that's all that Lizzie really takes action for. She sends Bridget to go get Alice Russell. And then when Bridget runs off around the corner, Lizzie stands there in the side door of the house, just standing there. Like, she's almost afraid to be in the house. She doesn't want to leave.
She's just sort of trapped in this kind of limbo right at that screen door. Yeah.
Yeah. And at that moment, her next door neighbor, Mrs. Churchill, who lives in the house next door, the Buffington house, she comes home from shopping. She's unpacking her groceries in her kitchen, and she looks out through the window and sees Lizzie Borden looking very distressed. And she says through the kitchen window, she asked her if anything's the matter. And Lizzie says famously,
"Oh, Mrs. Churchill, do come over. Someone has killed father." Which it is funny to say, because you can say it like it's an invitation to tea, which is kind of what they like to do on the tour at the Borden house. Or, you know, it clearly could have been said in great distress.
And as we found out last time, we don't know where the commas were.
No, we don't know where the commas were. Was father capitalized or not? I don't know. How did she spell O? I don't know.
Either way, things happen really quickly after this. I think it's Mrs. Churchill who's actually partly responsible for contacting the police, because she goes off to try to find some help, and she bumps into a news dealer on the street. He goes and he telephones the police.
He saw her running across the street and thought, well, that's odd, because, you know, a lady just wouldn't be hightailing it across the road like that.
And according to the police records, they got their call roughly about a quarter past the hour. So things happen really rapidly. I mean, the murder definitely took place around 11 o'clock.
Yep.
Whether Lizzie did it before 11 o'clock and just like took some time
and had some pears.
Yeah. Instead of eating some pears, you know, she went around hiding a bloody dress, or, you know, changing her clothes, or hiding the murder weapon. We'll never know. But she raised the alarm shortly after 11. By 11:20, I believe, the first police officer shows up.
Officer George Allen was the, he was not a patrolman. He was more of an office man, but because the police were having their annual picnic on Rocky Point, they were not operating it at a full level of usual staffing. So he was sent by the marshal down to see what's going on down there. And it seems the information they had was unclear. They thought maybe there'd been a fight or something. Officer Allen didn't quite know what he was going to find when he ran down the second street.
As a matter of fact, they heard there was a domestic disturbance. There may have been a stabbing. That's what the first reports were. So after Allen's arrival, again, just like the movements of the Borden family around the house early in the morning, there's a similar complexity to the arrival of certain people. And if you read through the trial testimonies, you get into a real complex maze.
Yeah, because it's really just a swarm of people. There's, you know, police and friends and newspapermen, because the fellow was at Cunningham who called the police. Also right after that, called two newspaper editors.
So things move quickly and people gathered really rapidly. Now, Dr. Bowen comes home. He comes over. He's there quite early, I believe before 11:30.
He said his wife met him. He wasn't even out of his carriage, you know, didn't have his foot on the sidewalk before his wife said, "They want you quick over to Mr. Borden."
So Dr. Bowen was the first medical man to see the crime scene. Now, we're only dealing with Andrew Borden right now. They have no idea where Abby Borden is. And famously, Lizzie Borden kind of says, Well, I think she got a note and somebody's sick and she went out to tend to somebody who was sick.
Or it was presumed that when Mrs. Borden went out to do the marketing, she was also going to visit this invalid.
Now, no such note has ever surfaced?
No. No snow boy who ever delivered such a note has ever surfaced.
And no person who ever claimed to have written the note has ever surfaced.
Yeah.
And when Abby Borden was found dead in the upstairs room, she certainly wasn't dressed for the outdoors.
No. Yeah, her work dress.
Right. So at this moment, all people know is that Andrew Borden has been murdered and nobody knows where Abby Borden is. So policemen show up, passersby stop and gawk at the house. Some of them even enter the house to look at the crime scene, which I find really incredible.
What?
Strangers walked in off the street to look at stuff.
Although they did, was it Officer Allen that deputized Mr. Sawyer, the painter, to stand guard at that back door where he stayed until well into the evening and finally asked, could he have some supper? Poor guy.
They did their best to contain the crime scene, but there was
a bit. They were terrible at it.
So at some point, it occurs to them to go look for Abby Borden. Lizzie even says, I think I heard her come in.
Right. So and something that I wish somebody would find Mrs. Borden. Because the Officer Allen came in and went, whoa, clearly he needs backup. So he doubles back to the station. So there's this little gap of quiet where it's just the women who have come to help Lizzie are in the house. Dr. Bowen's gone off to send a telegram to Emma to say, come home. Father's awfully sick. So there is this little lull where, yeah, they're tending to Lizzie, who was distraught, sort of quietly distraught in the style of Lizzie Borden. She wasn't flapping around and sobbing, but people who knew her well recognized that she was disturbed, you know.
At this point, she's sitting on the sofa in the dining room, and people are fanning her and trying
fanning
to console her.
Yeah, cool compresses and stuff like that. And she just says, has anybody seen Mrs. Borden?
And they decide to go off looking for her. They basically try to push Bridget Sullivan up the stairs, up the front stairs as a, you know, you go first. No, you go first.
Yeah. And people find it suspicious that Lizzie seems to have sort of directed them to go upstairs. But when you're familiar with the layout of the house and what had already been done, they'd gone upstairs up the back steps to get a sheet to cover Mr. Borden. So they knew the back half of the house was secure. And those upstairs is essentially two compartments, front and back, because of a mutually locked door in between. So in reality, it very much makes sense to go explore the front of the house because the back had already been, they'd been through it.
And they did not see Abby Borden in her half of the house.
No, and Bridget, when she comes down from being called by Lizzie, would have run right by Abby's bedroom door. So presumably, if Lizzie calls up that Father is hurt, Abby would have heard and come down if she was in her own room.
They make an attempt to go up the stairs. I believe it's Mrs. Churchill who winds up going first. And when she gets halfway up the stairs, her line of sight is now level with the floor, second floor of the house.
On the seventh step.
On the seventh step. And she could look across the floor into the guest room underneath the bed. And it's underneath the bed that she sees the body of Abby Borden lying dead face down on the floor in the guest room.
I think actually Bridget was ahead because it's Bridget who goes all the way into the room, goes to the foot of the bed and looks. Where Mrs. Churchill said she went not one step further. She ran back down the steps and was so disturbed. She doubled herself over and said, oh, Mrs. Borden.
Either way, it was a very traumatic sight. Clearly, there had been a tragedy of great magnitude that occurred in that house. I don't think anybody on the scene at that moment thought Lizzie Borden must have done this.
No. And there was the women were all very, very clear and in agreement that Lizzie did not appear. I mean, like her dress, her hair, nothing about her was in disarray. There was no blood, no soiling, not even her hair wasn't even mussed, which, you know, for women at that time was significant because you probably only washed your hair maybe once a week. It wasn't like you just, you know, jumped into the shower and got out the hair dryer. It was kind of an ordeal to get your hair just so. So for her hands, her dress, her shoes, and they were able to see her shoes when she laid on that little lounge in the dining room. There was not one speck of evidence on that woman.
And presumably whoever the killer was must have had a considerable amount of blood drenched on them.
You would think, yeah.
Because there was, according to the blood patterns on the walls at the crime scenes, there was a lot of blood flying around.
Yeah. Even in black and white, it's clear that that was not a neat and tidy scene.
For Lizzie to have gotten away with no blood on her whatsoever, even if she had time to change her dress.
Yeah.
And another thing that strikes me is that there really aren't bloody footprints walking away from any of the crime scenes.
No, not that anybody has detailed. And, you know, it's not even a matter of you can wash your hands in the sink and rinse the water. There was water in the running water in the kitchen sink. Is that correct? But, for example, upstairs where Mrs. Borden was found, it's just a washbowl. It's not like you can rinse the evidence away.
Yeah, there was a pantry off the kitchen, which is now a bathroom.
Most of the places in that house, yeah, where you can wash your hands, with the exception of that sink, you can clean yourself, but then you're left with bloody water that you have to also dispose of.
Right, as well as disposing of the hatchet, which, from my perspective, was found nowhere in the house. So the two victims of the crime have now been discovered, and Lizzie Borden is taken up to her room. She's in her room, sequestered with the two women, Alice Russell and Mrs. Churchill, and Dr. Bowen, who I believe administers the first dose to her.
He starts with bromocaffeine, which apparently is something, you know, about as potent as aspirin. I don't think the morphine happened until later that evening or possibly even the next day.
So he's giving her bromocaffeine to calm her down. She's clearly, unlike the police reports, which do say that she has kind of an uncanny calmness, she is undergoing a lot of stress and a lot of her nerves are really rattled.
She's just not, like, effusive about it. She's not sobbing. She's not flailing around. But, like I said, the people who know her are aware, they can tell that she's not herself. She's upset.
She's probably in shock.
Yeah.
So the police do something very odd that I always found very odd. They're searching the house, and they're looking for anything. They're looking for a murder weapon. They're looking for bloody clothing.
They're looking for a guy, like, hiding behind the dresses in the closet, holding a hatchet, wild-eyed. I don't know. I mean, when you
right.
think about what they're looking for, it's a little bit silly. They're not even really looking for clues. They're looking for, like, the dude who did it.
And when they get to Lizzie Borden's bedroom, they even knock politely and ask if they can come in. And Dr. Bowen actually negotiate with the police. You know, they say, well,
yeah.
She's not feeling very well. They negotiate that the police could search a little bit. And they come in and do kind of like a half search. You know, they certainly don't do the type of search where they're looking for evidence that Lizzie Borden committed these crimes. They're kind of respecting her female space. They're not doing anything to overly disturb her.
Yeah, they're not turning and tossing the mattress. They're not rooting through, you know, her underwear drawer or anything of that nature. They're just kind of like making sure there's nothing bloody or guilty in here.
And Lizzie did have opportunity then. She had space. She had opportunity. She had time to do things like change her clothing. As a matter of fact, she did change her clothing after the police arrived. It wasn't uncommon for a woman to change her clothing several times a day back then. But considering that this was a crucial investigation where the dress that she was wearing on the morning of the murders
yeah,
was absolutely vital to her defense.
It feels very strange to us.
The fact that nobody could get this straight about what she had on. At the trial, various people tried to describe the dress that she had on, and they all contradict each other.
And then on the other hand, you also have to consider that when Bridget went running to get Alice Russell and said, you know, Mr. Borden is sick, I don't know, but he might be dead, Alice Russell says, in effect, I'll be there as soon as I change my dress. And she did, in fact, change her dress before she went out to follow Bridget to what, for all she knew, was a deathbed. And Bridget herself also changed her dress later in that same day once the investigation was underway. So it is very strange on one hand, and on the other hand, not the least bit strange at all.
I believe if Lizzie Borden was innocent, she was in a lot of shock at this moment, and that protecting her was some instinct that the two women and Dr. Bowen had. Probably rightfully so, protecting her from further trauma. But the police did have an investigation. There's a lot of compromising of the crime scene that day, including the barn. They went to the barn to look to see if they could find her footprints in the dust to verify that she had been there. And they found people from the neighborhood, like, climbing all over the barn.
Yeah,
looking.
There were kids, there were reporters, yeah. I mean, they make it sound like the yard was just crawling with people, trying to, like, peek in windows and stuff.
I would believe it because I think hundreds and hundreds of people were starting to appear in the streets. Word was getting out around town. This was a major event. It might not have been a major event outside of Fall River at the moment, but it certainly stirred up the populace. There's all sorts of urban legends, you know, that people were dancing in the streets saying, you know, basically, ding dong, Andrew Borden is dead. A lot of people who felt that he had abused them money-wise were quite happy, but that might all be urban legend. Who knows? But either way, Andrew Borden was the type of person and he had the type of business and the type of public profile that his own daughter would not have been the first person that you would think of when you find out he was killed. I believe at first they assume that Andrew and Abby were killed at the same time. As a matter of fact, in the newspaper that came out that evening, the first report said that Abby Borden had walked in on her husband's killing and the killer chased her up the stairs.
There's another report that she saw him and died of fright.
Yeah, I don't know how fright could put, you know, that many hatchet blows into your skull, but...
Well, there was another report that it might have been a suicide. So, you know, there you go.
Well, I always subscribe to the single hatchet theory. You know, Oswald fired the hatchet out the sixth floor window and went through both heads. But nobody believes me.
And then he jumped down from the balcony and yelled, "Fix Emperor Tyrannus." Yeah. Anybody else?
But nobody believes me, and I know the truth. Well, the hatchet would have to have gone through a time machine. You know,
I suppose. That's probably where the blood got washed off.
Okay, Sarah, you've been listening to the Lizzie Borden Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Behrens, and we're talking with guest Sarah Miller, the author of The Borden Murders, Lizzie Borden, and The Trial of the Century. We're going to take a quick break now and listen to this word from Nine Muses Books.
Nine Muses Books is proud to sponsor the Lizzie Borden Podcast. Nine Muses Books is an independent press featuring the Lizzie Borden Girl Detective Mystery Series written by author Richard Behrens. These well-crafted comic mysteries set a fictionalized Lizzie as a teenage detective against a real Victorian-era Fall River, Massachusetts. The characters are remarkably vivid. The narrative is intellectually stimulating, and as one critic has described it, author Richard Behrens really knows how to toss delightfully deceptive literary curveballs that keep the reader mystified until just that penultimate perfect moment. Michael Martins of the Fall River Historical Society has called these stories a must-read for all those intrigued by Fall River history, mystery, and, of course, Lizzie Borden. Shelley Dezik of the Lizzie Borden Warps and Wefts blog has written that the Lizzie Borden Girl Detective stories are so much fun, it's nearly criminal. The Lizzie Borden Girl Detective Mysteries can be found on Amazon in ebook format, and most books are offered as free downloads. In addition to these short stories, there is also the full-length novel, The Minuscule Monk, offered in both print book and ebook formats. When a dead body mysteriously appears in the basement of her father's furniture store, 15-year-old Lizzie Andrew Borden takes on the case. Accompanied by an eccentric millionaire who campaigns to extend the vote to animals, a Boston Terrier trained to sniff out crooked politicians, and a boy detective who believes that the entire universe is inside his own head, Lizzie follows a trail of taxidermy tools and Civil War bushwhackers to the Minuscule Monk, a legendary gunslinger whose mummified body will bring a punter's pot to anyone who can deliver it to the New York gangster who has been hunting the monk for decades. With such high stakes, everyone has a motive for murder, yet everyone seems innocent. History and mystery fans alike will find The Minuscule Monk a thoroughly engaging read. For more information, go to LizzieBordenGirlDetective.com and sign up for our newsletter. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, and listen to our podcasts on iTunes. Visit the Garden Bay Films channel on YouTube to see special visual editions of the podcast as well as the Lizzie miniseries. And now, back to the Lizzie Borden Podcast.
Okay, we're back to the Lizzie Borden Podcast. And we've been talking about the day of the murders. When it comes to August 4th, 1892, we just have dozens and dozens and dozens of people testifying as to what happened and where they were and who said what. I think the most immediate detail that you can get is by reading the police statements and the witness statements that they're very clear, more focused on what happened that morning. And you have the policemen actually giving their impressions of what was being said. So at one point, one of the officers asks Lizzie about her mother. Lizzie throws a little bit of a fit and says, you know, "She's not my mother. She's my stepmother. My mother died when I was a child."
The assistant marshal was very, very unnerved, very just sort of gave him the willies, definitely gave him the willies. Prior to that, a few questions prior, there was something she offered the same level of precision about Bridget, because the nickname that Lizzie and her sister used for Bridget was Maggie, so she was referring to Maggie, and she stops him, she interrupts him, it seems, from his notes and corrects him to let him know that, no, this isn't really her name is Bridget, but we call her Maggie. So within that context, that mother remark is a little less weird.
That's right.
But it's very clear that Fleet, who was standing there receiving all of that information, including the context I just offered, was weirded out by the stepmother remark.
It's my understanding he arrived before the marshal himself.
Yes. I think the marshal doesn't turn up till about 3 p.m. I think Hilliard was at the police station, though, because he's the one who dispatched Officer Allen. But yeah, what he was doing after Allen came back breathless, saying "murder," why he didn't immediately come down with others of his men, I don't know. We don't know what else was on his docket that morning.
On the evening of the day of the murders, the house is closing down for the night. Everyone's going to sleep. But a couple of things. One is that the bodies are still in the house. They've been autopsied in the house, and they're actually lying on some autopsy boards in the dining room. And under those conditions, this family, including Uncle John, who has returned from Wabasset Street, and including Emma Borden, who has returned from Fairhaven, is joined by Alice Russell. And Alice Russell has decided to stay in Abby and Andrew's bedroom to spend the night, support Lizzie, be there with her. And Alice Russell freaks out because she looks under the bed and she finds a club. Now, this is a club that we believe Andrew Borden used for his own self-defense. But when you're in a house, presumably where two people were murdered by a maniac, it's kind of unnerving to find this weapon under your bed. So she runs to the police and they assure her that, you know, this is nothing to worry about. But either way, Alice stays in that room. Lizzie presumably is in her room and Emma is in her bedroom. And sometime towards, I think, 10 o'clock at night, Officer Hyde, who's a policeman who's stationed outside the house, watching the house for the night, he notices like the glow of lamps coming down from the upstairs rooms down into the basement. And it's Lizzie and Alice Russell paying a visit to the privy I guess they decided not to use their chamber pots.
Apparently, yeah.
They go down to the basement and then they go back up again. And then a short while later, Hyde notices that Lizzie is now going down to the basement alone by herself. And when she gets down to the basement, she's fiddling around by, I think it's the southeast window.
Yes, by the sink, because it's the sink that obscures his view of her. She bends down, and he knows that the basket full of the victim's clothing is nearby. He also knows that the bucket of Lizzie's menstrual rags is nearby. She didn't run any water. He knows that. What she did there, I do not know, he said, and I believe he said it took her less than a minute.
She clearly didn't go down there to go to the privy again. Yeah. She went down there to fiddle around in an area where there was a bucket of bloody rags.
Of course, the question is, why, with she was just there with what is presumed to be her closest friend.
Right.
What is she doing that she couldn't have done before? Did she just forget something? Or was something that she could not, for modesty's sake or for more sort of sinister reasons, not do in front of Alex Russell?
Right. We'll never know, because Lizzie never testified at her trial. And she was not asked about this incident at her inquest.
And Alice apparently was unaware, because they, after they came back up from the cellar together, had closed the connecting door between Lizzie's room and the master bedroom, so that Alice didn't know Lizzie had returned to the cellar.
Now we get to Friday. As you said before, not much happens on Friday, but there's an ongoing investigation. They pulled several axes and several hatchets out of the house. I mean,
came to collect the hatchet.
It was not out of the ordinary for a household in that time period to have axes and hatchets on the premises.
No, there were, what, four of them? And it seems like they were collected sort of in the spirit of get everything that could conceivably have caused these wounds. Not, this thing looks like it just did murder.
There was one blade that did have like a hair and some blood on it, but it turned out to be from
redness.
Turned out to be from a cow, I think. It was like cow blood.
And it's interesting to me, you know, I've never had reason or opportunity to examine hatchets for that reason, but that the police, when they did find some of these tools, weren't able to distinguish between rust and blood. There were reddish stains on some of these tools, but they were not aware which is it.
Well, they would have to send the evidence to a medical examiner, and that he would determine. I don't think the policeman on site looking at the stains on the hatchets would have that like Sherlock Holmes ability to be able to distinguish, you know, 20 different types of rust stains. Or Saturday morning is significant. This is Saturday, August 6th, because that morning was the morning of the funeral. The bodies were put into a receiving vault at Oak Grove. And on top of the bodies not actually being buried, but put into a receiving vault for medical examination reasons, the heads were actually removed from the bodies.
Yeah, I think when they did the formal autopsy, because what they'd done in the house was sort of provisional. They wanted to get those stomachs and make sure there was no evidence of poison. But it wasn't a true autopsy in the sense of, you know, really just sort of examining everything. But yeah, several days later, when the doctors did go in to examine the bodies more formally, they then were decapitated and the heads were taken away.
Yeah. Now, while the funeral was going on, something was happening that Lizzie and Emma were not privy to, which was that the house was being searched again from top to bottom.
Yes. As soon as the funeral cortege left, it sounds like the police were just basically at the back door waiting for the okay to go in. I think Alice Russell and another female friend, Mrs. Holmes, were in the house, and they did a search and left. And then, you know, the bereaved returned from the cemetery, where it appears that Lizzie and Emma were not aware, I don't think, that their parents were not immediately buried, because it was not the custom to stand there and watch the caskets go down and the dirt go on top. It was thought Victorian ladies just couldn't handle that anyway. So they came home, and on what, about 3 o'clock, police come back?
Yeah, the house has been pretty much roughed up during that time period.
Yeah, that quick search during the cemetery formalities was my understanding that was primarily targeted at Emma, Lizzie's room, and the guest bedroom. Due to Alice Russell having found that club under the bed, they kind of tossed the rooms a bit and then went away and came back then with a more formal, I don't know if they had a warrant, a search warrant, but the Borden's lawyer, Mr. Andrew Jennings, met the police there. So that was more formally arranged. And then they, for how many hours? 3 hours?
Now, it's increasingly clear at this point that the police are starting to suspect an inside job.
Yeah, but at the same time, Emma in particular, and also Lizzie by extension, are being very accommodating. It was Emma who said, if there's, you know, if you need a key to anything, if you can't open something, let us know. We will help you. And they did. There were two trunks up in the attic that the police were unable to open on their own. One because the lock mechanism was unfamiliar to them, and the other because they just hadn't noticed that the key was actually tied to the handle of the trunk on the side. But one or both of the Borden sisters came up to the third floor to assist the police when they asked for help with those two items.
It was during the search that they finally took away what is called the handleless hatchet that they found in a bin in the basement.
Yeah. They found this handleless hatchet and thought that it was suspicious because it looks to them as though it had been dusted or dipped in ash, possibly to conceal, make it look like it had been sitting gathering dust. But there was something different about the sediment on that hatchet head that made them suspicious. So they wrapped it up in paper and sent it to the marshal.
Now, this is a hatchet head that the prosecution was later to claim in court was the murder weapon. And it's also the a hatchet head that you could see physically at the Fall River Historical Society to this day. Now, the thinking that went into this is that if somebody used this hatchet to do the murders, by breaking the handle off, they make it seem like an old piece of junk that no one's used in a long time, and they would bring it down to the basement and go to like the dustbin and roll it around in the dirt to make it look like it's been covered. It's been, you know, a layer of dust has fallen on it because it hasn't been used in a while.
And there were literally bushel baskets of ash down in that basement from because they burned both coal and wood. And there's all this discussion in the trial about, well, was that wood ash or coal ash or what? Which is kind of mind-boggling to people like us who just magically have heat by flipping a switch.
Now, if there was a matter of minutes between the murder and getting rid of the hatchet, whoever used this handleless hatchet for the murder, they would have to, you know, do the break. They'd have to get rid of the handle because at least at first, the police claimed that there was no handle that they can find. We'll find out later during the trial that may not have been the case. But get rid of the handle, clean whatever blood was off. And, you know, how do you clean blood? You clean it with water, right? You clean blood off with liquid. You have to. I mean, there's no other way of getting blood off. So the hatchet handle would have been wet, which means it would have the dust would have collected on the hatchet head in a different way than if it had been dry when it was rolled around in the dust.
And you know, the officers all described that dust, sediment, whatever, in a different way, but they all agreed that it was different from the other sediment in that room where it was found in the cellar. So somebody says it was coarse and it was like dust, somebody says it was fine and it was like ash, but everybody agrees it didn't match the other stuff that was in the room.
Which is evidence that it may indeed be the murder weapon. It may have been manipulated at the time of the murders. So the next big event to happen after this was Saturday night, the cat gets out of the bag. The mayor of Fall River and Marshall Hilliard pay a visit to the Borden house, and they strongly recommend to them that these people, the family, stay in the house.
Yeah, well, Uncle John had basically been mobbed when he tried to go to the post office to get his mail. Was it that morning or Friday morning? I don't recall. And was ended up being escorted back to the house. Well, escorted to the post office and back because, fortunately, two officers had been, you know, assigned to sort of tail him because there was a bit of suspicion around him as well. But when he stepped out of the house, the public lost its mind and kind of wanted to lynch him.
I think the public's perception would have been more, you know, John Morris looked more like a person who would commit such murders. It was unthinkable that Lizzie Borden would have done it.
Yeah.
So Morris leaving the house, yeah, he was mobbed and the police had to pull him out.
Yeah, because the mayor says something about, well, you can ask, you know, Mr. Morris about that, you know, because they want to know, well, why can't we go out? Well, ask Mr. Morris because, you know, he sure knows why. But it's all said in a more sort of vague, like you had to be there terms to, everybody was clearly aware of the context where when you look at the words on the paper, it doesn't explicitly say that.
Well, the mayor and the marshal are in the house and they're advising the family to stay in for their own protection. And Lizzie does a very bold thing. She asks flat out to the marshal and to the mayor, is there anyone in this house who is suspected?
And they don't want to answer her. They try to evade, but Lizzie Borden does not tolerate that. She insists once or twice more, is there anyone in this house suspected?
And they tell her yes.
Yes.
In fact, Lizzie, you are. You are suspected. Yeah. This is something that was to come back up and bite them later, because at the time that they told her she was suspected, they basically signed an order for her arrest. They didn't tell her that. She didn't know about that. But it's the next day that she is interrogated at the inquest.
And she says something that to many people feels very suspicious. She says, I believe something to the effect of, I am ready to go at any moment.
Yeah.
And that's a big question. How do you interpret that? Does that mean I'm innocent? You have nothing on me? Let's do this. Let's prove it. Or does it mean, you know, the gig is up. Oh, you got me. Take me away.
She's basically informed that she's the prime suspect. And the next day she has to go under oath and be interrogated at the inquest. And an inquest technically is a fact-finding expedition.
Right. And it's usually, aren't they usually convened to determine whether foul play is involved? And I mean, that is the one thing that's perfectly clear from the outset in the Borden case. Yes, this is foul play.
But at the inquest the very next day, she is treated as if she's a murder suspect. She's hit very hard.
Well, even just objectively, the number of questions speak for themselves. I mean, she's asked something like 800 questions. As opposed to, you know, maybe 100, 150 or so that other people. We don't know how many questions Bridget was subjected to because that testimony is lost. But clearly the bulk of the fact-finding expedition is centered on Lizzie. And, you know, okay, in part because she was in the house, you know. There's only so many people who were on the property at the time of the crime.
The way that she's interrogated at the inquest is pretty harsh.
Yeah, and I hate to blame the victim, but when you read her testimony, she does very little to help herself. She splits hairs. She answers questions to the letter. You can, in some cases, it's quite clear what the prosecutor is trying to, the information he's trying to obtain from her. Maybe he doesn't ask it in exactly those terms, but she answers in exactly his terms. And it just, I guess it's hard to be sure because you only have the words on the paper, but he seems frustrated. He seems irritated with her. It feels, I think I said in my book, it feels like they're arguing like brother and sister, but they're just almost needling each other.
That's a good metaphor, yeah. If that inquest testimony had been entered into her trial, things may have been different.
Yeah.
She may have been convicted based on that testimony alone. But one of the legal arguments against admitting the testimony into the record of the trial is that she had been informed that she was a suspect.
Yes.
And that legal protocol had been turned on its head because of this. That there already was a warrant for her arrest when she testified at the inquest. So this is one way in which her defense attorneys were brilliantly able to avoid that testimony being put into the record of the trial.
Because it is just, frankly, a mess. If she was trying to prove herself innocent, she was awful at it. all she did was raise even more suspicion against herself.
Yeah, she's interrogated at the inquest in three sessions over 3 days.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people think that this, you know, she was interrogated for 3 days. That sounds harsh in itself, but she wasn't there. She wasn't interrogated like all day. I mean, it was some total of maybe about 2.5 hours altogether.
Well, however long it takes to ask approximately 850 questions. But, you know, she slept in her own bed. Monday and Tuesday, two nights she spent at home. She was taken back in a carriage, go back to your home, and was brought back the next day. She was not kept in jail or anything like that. But she was still under house arrest.
She was still under house arrest. She was not allowed to have her attorney present at the inquest.
Yeah.
Some of the more troubling spots in her testimony is exactly where was she when her father came home? Was she upstairs or downstairs? The fact that she contradicts herself is not really damning enough. It's just that if she's lying about being upstairs, that means she's trying to position herself away from the dead body of Abby Borden that hasn't been discovered yet. So that's really a big deal. How did you fill in your time? Were you reading magazines? Were you ironing handkerchiefs?
What made you decide to go out to the barn? And she says, quite frankly, I can't tell you any reason. It appears that it was just, if she's telling the truth, it was just one of those things where you think, oh, I'm going fishing on Monday. I should go see if I have what I need. But in the context of this murder, the idea of that thought dawning on her in the 20-minute time frame where her father is chopped up strikes us as just ludicrous.
And she waffles on what she was actually looking for. It's generally centered around fishing equipment.
Right. In metal.
Yeah. Where is it located in the barn? Is it upstairs? Is it downstairs?
And there was also a point at which, maybe this was not in the inquest itself, but I think it was Alice Russell mentioned, and or Mrs. Churchill, she said she'd been looking for a bit of tin to mend a screen in the house.
Yes.
Now, is it not possible to go out in search of one thing and it occurs to you it's very similar to this other thing that you also need? Sure. But we just want it to be clear and precise, and it's not.
It's a very frustrating testimony because you're trying to get things straight. You're trying to put together a coherent story, and it's just not
possible.
It's just not cohering. And that's to Lizzie Borden's, it didn't help her any.
No.
And it possibly would have sent her to the gallows.
And, you know, even in cases where, questions where volunteering more information would help her, it would tend to show innocence. She did not take that opportunity. That's what's frustrating also, you know, from the outside. It's like, why can't you even help yourself? If you are trying to hinder this man, okay, fine, but can't you also throw the man a bone?
We discussed this before, that if somebody is giving erratic testimony, that might actually be the case that they're telling the truth, because not everyone's memory is perfect. She's under a lot of stress. It's only been a few days since her father and her stepmother have been brutally murdered, and she discovered the bodies. You know, so it's understandable if she could have little clarity of mind.
Right.
And also on top of that, Dr. Bowen had elevated from bromocaffeine. He was now flat out giving her morphine.
And
before the inquest testimony, he doubled his dose of the morphine, according to his own testimony. So there's a lot to be said for her being unclear. There's even a part in the testimony where she says to Knowlton, I don't know. I don't know what your name is.
Yeah.
So, you know, she could be in a, you know, for anyone who is, like one time I broke my leg and I was on morphine for about 3 months, which, by the way, morphine is great. I love morphine.
It performs as advertised, huh?
I really like, as long as I had to lie in bed and do nothing for 3 months. But I remember, you know, saying silly things and being unclear and, you know, forgetting where I was and everything. And I thought about Lizzie Borden the whole time I had my broken leg and I was on morphine.
Well, and you see these videos that people take, you know, when they pick up their brother, sister, friend from having their wisdom teeth taken out, and they're still jacked up on the meds just from that short procedure, and they're just...
Yeah,
it's mean, but it's funny.
Yeah, they try to take their pants off over their head, you know, so things that. So it's understandable, but at the same time, there's a fundamental problem.
Disquieting.
Yeah, like what you said before, she's almost antagonistic for the sake of it.
And so is he, really. I mean, and I attribute that to frustration because, I mean, he must have known he was not a dumb man. He was known to be careful handling a female in that time and culture, and B, somebody who is possibly just been orphaned, not by her own hand.
Now, we're talking about Hosea Knowlton, who was the district attorney for the Southern District of Massachusetts, later to be the attorney general. So he was a pretty heavy hitter in the legal system at that time. And he took on this case, and his performance at the inquest testimony, where he hammered away at Lizzie Borden, some would say mercilessly, was the inauspicious start for a very long ordeal that Lizzie Borden endured. Because almost immediately after her third day of testimony, she was arrested.
At the close of that third day, they didn't send her home. They sent her to the matron's room, where she just sort of flopped onto a sofa there. I believe they brought dinner for her and Emma and whoever was accompanying her. There was another female friend. And when they came in then to perform the formalities of the arrest, somebody noted that the food had not been touched. And Lizzie had not apparently moved from that couch where she'd flopped down.
And she was to remain incarcerated for the remainder of 1892 and all the way up until the end of June of 1893, when she was acquitted at her trial. Okay, we have to stop now, but we'll be back with a Lizzie Borden Primer Part 3, where we'll take a look at the trial of Lizzie Borden and its aftermath, and then in a later episode, Lizzie's life at Maplecroft and the notorious scandals of her later years. We've been chatting with Sarah Miller, author of The Borden Murders, Lizzie Borden and the Trial of the Century. We'll see you next time on the Lizzie Borden Podcast. You have been listening to the Lizzie Borden Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Behrens. This podcast was written and produced by Nine Muses Books and engineered by Mason Amadeus. The theme music was composed and performed by Melora Krieger. The Lizzie Borden Podcast is sponsored by Nine Muses Books and the Lizzie Borden Girl Detective Mystery Series. More information can be found at www.lizziebordenpodcast.com and www.lizziebordengirldetective.com.